On this episode of TWiET, the IRS misses their deadline, the FCC can sue to protect your privacy, and small to medium business gets sucked into the vortex. TWiET on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiET.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 87, recorded April 14th, 2014. SMBs spinning in the vortex. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of Legal Plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace which connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Welcome to TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Balasair, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm joined by an all-star cast of enterprise geeks, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how are you today?
I'm doing great, and I've finally made my mind up. I'm going to buy the fifth generation MakerBot replicator and a 3D scanner because we want to be able to go and repair parts like my broken microphone stand.
Oh, I don't know, man. I don't know if I trust you with both a 3D scanner and a 3D printer. All sorts of weird things will... Never mind. Let's go move on. Next up is, a man who is no stranger to the show, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, it is great to see you. How are things over at the right coast?
Andre, it's a great day here in Florida. The only problem is it looks like we're going to be socked in for tonight's lunar eclipse. But barring that, it's a superb day, mid-80s, a perfect afternoon for a little bit of TWiET.
Speaking of a little bit of TWiET, I thought maybe we should kick it off right with an enterprise bite about taxes. No, I'm not talking about tax day. We know that for all you United States citizens, tax day is tomorrow, the tax man cometh. But we're talking about the lighter side of taxes, specifically speaking about how the IRS has missed their own deadline. That's right, the United States Internal Revenue Service is not going to quite meet their redeployment plan for Windows XP. That means they're falling into the Xpocalypse. Now, we ran a story about this last week, talking about how there are a couple of overseas agencies, most notably the UK, how they have fallen into this trap and are paying Microsoft for continued support. Well, now it seems that our very own IRS, one of the United States' most beloved of agencies, is going to do the very same thing. Now, last Monday, IRS Commissioner John Kuskinskin, I'm just going to call him John K., he told the House Subcommittee on Financial Services and Government that the agency was less than halfway through its XP migration plan, and that the full migration will take an untold amount of time and $30 million more. Now, let me state that that puts it in the budget that they said it was going to cost. They said they were going to need $78 million for the full deployment, the migration of roughly 100,000 employees off of XP. But it also means that since they didn't make it, and since they are held to a higher standard as far as customer security is concerned, they're now going to have to pay Microsoft for continued support for Windows XP. Now, this means that they're going to have to ask for a similar deal to what the UK is getting on their 90,000-plus PCs. We don't yet know exactly how expensive it's going to be, but we know it's going to cost a pretty penny. Let me start with you, Brian. We knew this was going to happen, right? I mean, we knew that some government agencies are going to run into this. The IRS is probably just the first, but does it strike you that they're less than halfway through their migration?
No, this is about right. Got to get slapped around before you actually come into compliance. I shouldn't talk. The University of Hawaii has an awful lot of XP machines still, and but their attitude is, I'm just going to stick my head in the sand, and I'm just not going to worry about them because you know, out of sight, out of mind. I keep hoping they actually do patch it because I'd really like to have my networks a little cleaner than they have been in the past.
Yeah. Curtis, I want to throw over to you. There is this little point that's been gnawing on my brain, and that is in quarter three of 2013, the average cost for a brand spanking new PC was $545. Now, the IRS estimate of those 100,000 machines means that they're spending approximately $800 for each new desktop. Does $250 or so per PC sound reasonable for installation, for management, for troubleshooting?
Oh, I think that $250 per PC is cheap. Remember that what they've got to do is go through and do extensive testing of all their applications. They've got to do extensive testing of all their configurations. By the time you wrap up all the human resources that are involved in a big OS migration, and this counts, spending $1,000 plus per machine is not at all out of the question. I talk to people all the time who say that when you're doing something like this, you really have to go through, and the number of total applications, services, and just various components that must be checked can easily rank in the tens of thousands. Making sure that that's going to work takes money. And I think that this is a case where the original budget was probably quite good. It's the timeline that has turned around to bite them badly.
Right. Chibert, let me go over to you. Let me continue that. Along with this migration, and Curtis is right in saying, look, $250 per PC actually isn't a lot of money. It's a lot of money when we think, really, that's what support's going to cost. But in an enterprise, $250 accounts for all the time you're going to have to make, you're going to use to make sure that the PC is installed properly, that it's going to be using the network properly, that all the credentials are protected properly. But let me ask you this. In the story, they admitted that they're not migrating to Windows 8. They're migrating to Windows 7. So they're moving over their entire infrastructure to Windows 7, which is a great operating system, but is already 5 years old. Are they just kicking the can down the road? I mean, Microsoft has already said they're not going to go back to Windows 7. That this new style of Windows kernel and Windows interface is here to stay. Are we going to be looking 9 years down the road to the IRS having to do this all over again?
Actually, it's my hope that it's not. It is my sincere hope that behind the scenes, the IRS information technology people are actually taking a look at doing something reasonable, like thin clients or desktop management. Both Citrix, all the big players, Citrix, VMware, and Microsoft, all have the ability of rolling out compliance packages to either full thick workstations, laptops, or thin clients. That's a much, much more reasonable attitude because that also makes it dramatically easier to do another step, and that's into Windows 8 when the IT group has vetted that new operating system. Keep in mind, you know, something like the IRS takes many years to vet an operating system before they're willing to move on. Just look at what's happening with the Department of Defense. They've got islands of Windows 7, islands of Windows 8, and it's based upon who's doing the vetting. So, yeah, I think the IRS probably should, if they aren't looking at thin clients, they should be, because that'll make migration dramatically easier the next time. But at the very least, they should be looking at the new systems for compliance packages.
All right. Curtis, what do you think about that? I mean, that has actually surprised me that during this big push for the Xpocalypse, this last 18 months or so, we haven't heard from any of the big players in thin client or in distributed computing that their solution would be a great way to reach compliance. That if you're going to be swapping out your 100,000 plus seat XP network, why not move to a solution that can be easily upgraded to the next solution and the next solution and the next? Why do you think that it's been kind of silent on the thin client front?
I think it's an education problem. You know, you talk to a number of vendors who say that the real problem is not so much convincing someone once they understand what's involved. It's the education process. Having to educate companies and more specifically purchasing agents on precisely what's involved, what virtualization means, going through the entire education process is expensive. It makes for a very long sales cycle and an exceptionally high cost per sale. Now, when margins have been cut the way they have in the PC industry, that can take a project from profitable to not really profitable very quickly. I think that you are going to start seeing more of that, but, you know, frankly, for many, many companies, going not only from XP to Windows 7 or 8, but also to a virtual desktop environment is just a step too far. It's one thing more than they can culturally and technologically handle at one time. I agree with Chebert. It makes a ton of sense. And to be brutally honest, if I were managing something like this, it's something I would be looking at very hard. But for an organization as large as the IRS, I think that they looked at what was possible in the time frame that they had, decided on the upgrade, and frankly, still missed on the time estimate.
Got it. Well, I think, gentlemen, we should probably move on. We've beat the X-pocalypse into the ground. We've got a different kind of juicier story for our second Enterprise Bite, and that is, well, guess what? The FTC can now sue companies over data breaches. I actually kind of like this. A federal judge has affirmed the FTC's right to sue companies if they suffer a data breach after failing to take reasonable and appropriate data security measures. Now, the decision comes after Wyndham, you may know them, the hotel giant, filed a motion to dismiss a 2012 FTC suit against the hotel giant after their repeated failures to protect customer data between 2008 and 2010. Now, those repeated failures to protect customer data included things like employees were allowed to use permanent, easy-to-guess passwords. Systems with customer information were left connected to the internet even without even the most rudimentary firewall. Physical loss of servers and the inability to locate servers on the active network. Storage of customer information in clear text, including names, phone numbers, credit cards. So those are the things that Wyndham did, and they said the FTC can't actually sue them for negligence in storing their data. Well, the federal court has now said, no, the FTC can do this, and we're going forward with more and more of these cases. I'm going to throw this over to you first, Brian. This I see as a positive step. If companies now know that it's not just a pie in the face in terms of PR or in terms of their own personal reputation in front of their customers, but know that they could be held financially responsible for not protecting customer data, I think this gives us that impetus. Remember, we talked a little bit a while ago about the PCI DSS rules. Well, people said it's all about the money, and as long as it's not more expensive to deal with the fallout than to deploy new systems, we were going to continue to have those kinds of breaches. Well, if the FTC can now make it more expensive than less expensive, does this give them the reason to upgrade?
Yes, it certainly does. And actually, what you haven't said is if the FTC has opened this door, that also has opened the door for civil lawsuits for negligence. So, bang, I think Wyndham needs to go and get their act together. And I think it's a good lesson for a lot of corporations that if consumers are going to be trusting you with their personally identifiable information, PII, that it is your responsibility to protect it. So I'm glad to see this happening.
Right. Curtis, I want to continue what Chebert started with, that whole idea of, well, what does this mean in the future? The fact that the FTC is allowed to sue means that the federal courts are now acknowledging the financial equivalence of data security. In other words, before this decision, it was very difficult to get any sort of decision that specifically said, yes, data can be damaged. Data is worth something. And if you do not protect that worth, then you are legally responsible for damaging that worth, that data. What do you see as the repercussions for this? Because I look at this decision. I look at a federal court saying, yeah, you can be held legally responsible, financially responsible for losing data. And then I look at some of the court decisions from the past year or so talking about the seizing of data because data is not worth anything.
Yeah, this really does open up any number of cans of worms. The one that you bring up is very important. Does data have value or not? Can it legally have value in one context with the FTC and no value in another context, the DOJ? And the thing that really gets to me, and the one that's going to keep a lot of attorneys employed for a long time, is over the two key words that we had, the reasonable and appropriate data security measures. What is reasonable and appropriate? Those are terms of art. Those are terms that will need to be defined by the court. Is this one where meeting certain standards is evidence of automatically being reasonable and appropriate? Does reasonable and appropriate change from scenario to scenario? Those are the sorts of questions that are going to have the companies out there worried about this, and frankly, probably have any number of law firms licking their metaphorical chops, looking forward to huge numbers of billable hours in the coming decade.
Got it. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about a tax man to the north. And of course, we've got to talk all about Heartbleed. But before that, I thought maybe this might be a good time to talk about the first sponsor of the Twight Riot. We welcome to the show brand new sponsor, LegalZoom.com. Now, modern technology is great. We love our smartphones. We love our laptops. We love our desktops. Our iPads and our gadgets make it easy to do so many things at the same time. But with all this tech and all these services around us, why is it that our lives seem busier at any given moment? Well, maybe it's because even though we're surrounded by tech and besieged by services, too much of it demands that we work around it instead of it conforming to the way that we want to do business. LegalZoom gets that. That's why when it comes to getting the legal help that you need, LegalZoom provides a great solution that works with your busy schedule. Now, let's face it. The legal system is complicated. There are better things that you can do with your time, so thankfully, LegalZoom is there to help you. If you're thinking about starting a business, forming an LLC, or getting a trademark, will, or living trust, LegalZoom gets the job done right the way you need to get done. Now, you get the personal attention that you need, and they'll help you take care of all the details. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help services, but importantly, it's not a law firm. They, in other words, they understand that they need to speak to you in English. They have to explain the process so you understand it. LegalZoom has been helping families and small business owners for 14 years, and they received an A+ from the Better Business Bureau. So here's what we want you to do. Here's what we want the Twight Riot to be called to action to do. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code ENTERPRISE to save on your legal needs and also get access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. Don't put off the things that you need to do. Go to LegalZoom.com now and use the offer code ENTERPRISE. That's LegalZoom.com, offer code ENTERPRISE, to receive $10 off at checkout. And we thank LegalZoom for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. It seems as if the United States Internal Revenue Service is not the only tax agency that's having a hard go at it this tax season. In Canada, the tax man cometh to 900 social insurance numbers that were stolen with Heartbleed. Now, this is it's a story that you kind of have to dig into. There's not a lot of details coming out, but let me tell you what we think we know. The Canadian Revenue Service has said that the Heartbleed bug is to blame for data theft from their systems. They found the breach when they were updating their systems to patch the affected OpenSSL Heartbleed bug. Now, they say that the theft occurred in a six-hour window between the announcement of the bug and the time that they brought their servers down for the patching. They say in that time, someone exploited the Heartbleed bug to steal 900 records from their systems. Now, they're reaching out to those affected people. They're actually reaching out to them via mail because they don't want to use phone or email because that's just too easy a vector to take advantage of someone. But at the same time, there's a lot of questions surrounding this because people aren't really sure how they know it's the Heartbleed bug that caused this loss of data, nor are they really sure how they know it was just 900 records. Cheebert, we're going to talk a little bit about Heartbleed next week. We've actually got a security expert coming on. But what is it? We know that the heartbeat isn't logged. So how do they know that it was this exploit that caused the loss of records?
You know, I'm still trying to figure out, because a lot of times when people are going to go in, the first things they're going to go after are the logs. So that unless their logs are backed up someplace, you know, very, very, very difficult to get at, I, too, am wondering how the heck they know which records got grabbed, which records didn't, and also how they can really depend, you know, determine how many, you know, how they got in. That, I don't know. You know, I'm sitting here scratching my head going, huh, really?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of IT people who are, as you said, they're scratching their heads going, wait a minute. I mean, A, how do you know that the Heartbleed bug was exploited? Because again, as we know, if you've even read the most rudimentary coverage of the Heartbleed bug, you know that we don't log heartbeats. So if we're not logging heartbeats, how would they know that that's the vector of attack? And also, because they haven't released any information about how they know it's 900, it kind of begs the question, well, is this just a convenient blaming of a new exploit for something that's been sitting around in the system for a long time? Is this coming out of fear, or do they actually have some sort of way to detect the heartbeat exploit that they haven't told the rest of the world about? Curtis, coming from you, so you know, acknowledge that you're not from a pure engineering background. You're more from the executive side. This is sort of the de facto nightmare of any executive for a company that deals with sensitive information right now, right? That somehow they're going to be exploited by this zero-day bug that no one really knows how to fix.
Oh, yeah. This is absolutely the worst-case scenario. It's a zero-day bug that no one knew how to fix right off, and that really leaves no trace of itself in the system logs. As you say, the heartbeats are not logged. So you have to end up doing all sorts of vague correlations. In this case, we trust the Canadian government to say, well, these records were accessed somehow. We don't know how they're figuring that out in the time, and therefore we assume that it was the Heartbleed. But really, to be brutally honest, this is the sort of thing, the exact number 900, the correlation with the time, it smacks of a number thrown out in order to keep people from asking deeper questions. I am a suspicious person when it comes to what large companies and government agencies tell us. I suspect there may be more than this that got out there, that they're going back and trying to figure out how long the port was open. We know that this was in the wild for, what, 2 years before it was discovered by a legitimate researcher, and that very quietly an awful lot of people, far more than 900, are going to end up getting letters telling them that their personal information might just have been compromised.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we've got great smart people in the chat room. We've got Scott Michaud, we've got CyberDog, who are both correctly saying, well, maybe they were watching their outbound traffic, and maybe they were just looking at the log. Someone logged in with a compromised username and password, and suddenly they were sucking down the information, and that was logged. Now, that's all true. I mean, if it's a system worth its salt, they absolutely should have logged legal logins, and they can go back through the files and determine that, yes, these files were taken by someone who should not have had access. But the question remains, how did they know to blame Heartbleed? I mean, if it is just someone who logged in and downloaded a bunch of records they shouldn't have downloaded, couldn't it have been from anything? It could have been from a compromised user. It could have been from a disgruntled user. It could have been from someone leaving their username and their password in a stupid place. It doesn't necessarily have to be Heartbleed. Now, I know we're going to cover this in depth next week. We actually wanted to give it a week off. We know that this announcement was made last week. I asked Raphael Mudge, who has been our security guru, to come in for next week's episode, which is actually going to be taped this Friday, to specifically talk about all the permutations of attack. They're already working on all the exploit tools. So he's going to give us the in-depth analysis of what you can do with this exploit. But what we know is we know that it circles around the way that OpenSSL handles a heartbeat. We know that a heartbeat is the signal. It's the payload that you send off to the server that's returned to you that lets you keep open a secure connection. In other words, if I make a secure connection to, say, Facebook, I send off a heartbeat every once in a while along with a payload saying, keep open this connection, pair, and it's going to send me back pair. And if I get back what I sent, I know that both the connection is still on and I know that we're still secure. Specifically, what the Heartbleed bug is a flaw in the way OpenSSL checks the length of the payload. because within that heartbeat signature, I'm allowed to tell it how big of a payload I'm sending. So typically, if I say I'm sending pair, P-E-A-R, it's 4 bytes, it's 4 characters. I say, send me back pair, 4 characters, and the server sends me back pair, 4 characters. Now, in other implementations of SSL from Microsoft and Apple and Oracle, they always make sure to check that signature against how many characters, how much data has actually made it across the connection. So if I say, send me pair, which is 4 characters, but I sent you 20 characters. Let's say I say I sent 20 characters. The server will actually say, no, 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 you didn't send me 20. You sent me 4, so therefore this is invalid. OpenSSL doesn't check that, which means I could say, send me pair, but I sent you 64 characters. And it's now going to send me back 60 characters that I should not have received. That's the basis of Heartbleed. That's what we're talking about. That's the memory leak that allows people over time to collect everything that is in the memory buffer. Which again, Chibert, going back to you, since we're not logging that, since we have no way to actually figure out what has been taken from memory, is there a way to detect the Heartbleed bug that we haven't heard about yet?
Yeah, and I'm surprised it hasn't had a lot of press yet. But the devices like the NetScout and Finistream, Network Instruments has one, the various other, even Wildpack has something similar. All it's doing is it's recording off the taps and it's recording all the metadata. Now, from that metadata, you can get most of what you need to find out. You can at least get the payload sizes and you can get the timing. So from that, you can go back in time. So if the Canadians figured out they had a breach, they can actually go back in time and at least rewind the metadata to go find out what the heck's going on. That's also how we found some attacks coming against Interop. And having that metadata cache, a many, many terabyte metadata cache, has saved our bacon many, many times at this very large trade show.
Got it. Okay. Well, actually, I will say this. Over the weekend, I did set up a honeypot running the infected version, the affected version of OpenSSL, and not advertised, completely not advertised. I've already received 2 nibbles from people using what I think was the Heartbleed exploit. But interestingly enough, again, because it's not logged, what I had to do is I had to look at behavior. I had to look at strange sorts of connections that were scanning multiple IPs on my ranges before they found the OpenSSL and then focusing on that. As far as I know, that's really the only way to tell whether or not you're being hit by this exploit. Now, Curtis, let me ask you this. Do you think there's any interest in the enterprise for people to actually figure out whether or not they're being hit, or their mandate is just patch it, get rid of it?
I suspect that there are a lot of people who are asking their IT departments to go through and do an audit to see whether or not they have been hit. The reason for that is the potential for lawsuits. If someone has been hit, if they have had sensitive customer information access, they want to be the one to tell the customer rather than allowing the customer to find out about it and then possibly put it together with other customer stories and bring up words like class action. I think that especially the larger companies, anywhere from the middle of the mid-sized tier up, are going to be doing audits to find out if they've been affected. Now, while this is going on, everyone is certainly telling their IT folks to get this fixed as quickly as possible. And I suspect that a few of the more forward-looking are also asking their IT departments the question of why they weren't the ones to figure out what was going on. So there's going to be a range, but this is one where I suspect people are taking it seriously. They want to know if their customers were affected and try to get out in front of it before some enterprising attorney gets there first.
Got it. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I don't want to go too much into Heartbleed because, again, coming Friday for next week's episode, we will be speaking in depth about Heartbleed. So make sure you tune in for that if you want to know more about how this latest zero day is affecting IT. Now, before we get to our guests, and we've got a doozy because we're doing a small to medium business special for you, I thought maybe now might be a good time to talk about the second sponsor of the Twilight Right. And, of course, that's Prosper. Now, let me ask you a question. If you knew that in 72 hours you could have $35,000 to do whatever you wanted to with, to cover your needs, what would you do with it? Would you pay off your high-rate credit cards? Would you start a business? Would you finally do that home improvement project that you've been putting off year after year? Well, what if I told you that by filling out an easy online application and providing a few details, you could see a rate online, instantly, without ever stepping foot in a bank? Well, that's not a fantasy, people. That's Prosper. A Prosper is an innovative peer-to-peer lending process. It's Silicon Valley's answer to a more modern community-based personal loan. There are no outrageous fees, no raising interest rates, and yes, you'll never set foot in a bank. Now, Prosper offers low fixed rates, unsecured personal loans, which means that there's no collateral required, and has multi-year terms available. Prosper has more than 2 million members, lenders, and borrowers, and over $1 billion in funded loans. Now, folks, this is peer-to-peer lending. Now, we've heard of programs like this, usually in the third world or as microloans, but it's time that peer-to-peer made it into our financial vocabulary. Because Prosper connects people who need money with those who have it to loan. It's really that simple. Just go to prosper.com/twit to check your rate instantly without affecting your credit score. Now again, for a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com is not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. And we thank Prosper for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We welcome to the show a man who has made it all the way into the studio, which we always love, Mr. Mike Salem from Vorex. Mike, thank you very much for making the trip.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to tell the folks at home just who you are and what does your company do?
All right. In a nutshell, I'm originally from, my company is from Dallas, Texas, and I'm so glad to be in San Francisco because 2 weeks ago we were hiding from a tornado literally under the stairs in the house, so it's good to be in the Bay Area. Our company addresses the issues that small businesses run into when it comes to technology, and it is having a good solution that covers A to Z, or at least most of the letters between A to Z, in one comprehensive solution. So it is an application. It is a professional service automation solution overall, PSA they call it, which is project management, invoicing and CRM. But our focus is a solution for the small business more than just another application on your desktop.
Got it. Now, I got to ask this. Why wouldn't someone just use a solution that was already built for the enterprise? We've seen this all the time. In fact, we've had several vendors come through this very show to talk about management solutions that will do everything from your back end to your billing. What makes your solution better for SMBs than, say, someone who has built a software suite for a 10,000-seat enterprise network?
Okay. The idea behind Vorex was let's get what the big players in the market offer for the enterprise, Oracle, let's say, SAP, and condense it to be a good fit for small businesses. For example, the three things that distinguishes us from different vendors out there is, one, the comprehensiveness. It really covers, and we could talk about this in a little bit more details, but from the sales process, CRM, all the way to project management, all the way to invoicing and everything in between, including an HR in one. Another thing that is very important is the pricing. That's a huge thing. Small businesses cannot afford a $5,000 setup fee and $2,000 a month when they have maybe 5 employees in the company. The pricing is very, very affordable for small companies. No contracts, for example. That's a big thing. The other third important thing, and that's, I think, very important across enterprise solution all the way to the Facebooks of the world, is the user interface. That's very important. It's becoming very critical that a solution needs to be easy and it makes sense. Everybody tries and strives after that, but I don't think many people do a good job at it, many companies. And we try, maybe we're not perfect, to hit that specific point, because for small businesses and any business and a LinkedIn user, for that matter, they want something easy. We're moving towards that, that era in technology, that the technology is there. There are no limits. That's not the point anymore. It's not. It's how easy it is and how intuitive the software is. And that's a big factor in our solution.
All right, let's back this up, because our audience is really sensitive to PR buzzwords. They tear us apart any time that we let a guest get away with what they think is just talking points. So let's get down to basics. When you were designing this solution, when you were designing this suite, what were the things that you thought every SMB is going to have to do? And so, in other words, how did the decision-making process go to decide, okay, an SMB is going to need billing, an SMB is going to need invoicing, an SMB is going to need time management, an SMB is going to need this and that, but not why? What went into that pot?
Excellent question, actually, Padre. Where when we started, actually, we did not design it out of the thin air. We didn't go, okay, we're going to create a great software, let's put some people together and develop something. It took us a long time, actually, literally over a year and a half, talking to small businesses. We brought in friends, we brought in consultants, we brought in people we did not know, we literally solicited. And we put them together or individually, and we told them, if you would have a dream software that does that. I mean, we had the concept. It's going to be a PSA. What would it be? You know, help us. Draw it for us. And we sat down with them. Blueprints were really written and drawn by small business owners. And that's how we developed the software, based on what they told us. Until this day, by the way, I would say at least 95% of the releases we put in are based on what the clients tell us. We do not dream up things. I mean, the changes, unless there are infrastructure, security, database, all these, you know, technical stuff we have to do, but other than that, we hear, we listen, and that's what you do. And it's really not a PR thing. That's exactly how we develop the software.
Oh, we have a great chat room here, and Big Ginge in our chat room comes up with a really good point. He says, listen, turnkey systems are good as long as you don't have to buy one extra product to fill the gap. And I think that's actually very true, especially when you're talking about SMB, because there's not as much money in the budget as there would be in a major enterprise type environment. You need to make sure you buy a suite that's going to work well with all the different things you need to do in a small to medium business without saying, okay, this works well except for taxes. And we need a separate suite to get taxes, and we need to be able to import that information over, and it's going to be a pain in the butt. And boy, wouldn't it be good if we had that module. What do you do to make sure that your turnkey solution is actually turnkey?
That's another good question. We have a great audience. I mean, it's like they're part of our team when they ask these questions. Let's be realistic here. I'm just going to be honest and transparent. I don't think really there is a system that can solve everything, not even Oracle. I don't think it exists. There are always going to be specialized niches in certain industries that you will always have to have the specialized software for it. That's just how it is. I believe so. The question is, what are the other 99% of the things you do at work outside of that specialized CAD software or specialized international tax software that you have? And that's the area we cover. So I believe we do a good job at it. I believe it's a very diverse software. We have clients from healthcare all the way to architecture to marketing companies. So it seems like we're doing a good job in being flexible with these solutions. Obviously, the bread and butter always and the focus is towards companies that are project-oriented overall. The solution does not speak, is not heavy in jargons. I mean, yeah, you could customize the fields and what have you and all this good technical stuff, but it is very flexible. It can move with the industries very smoothly when it comes to, does it work for this industry or that industry?
Okay. Now, Mike, what modules are, let's actually start talking about the solution.
Sure.
What modules are in there? So if I am running that small to medium business and I buy your turnkey solution, I buy Vorex PSA 360, what do I get?
All right. What do you get? So we'll talk about the Vorex 360 to your point, because it is the most comprehensive out of the three packages. It starts with a module where, you know, where the front end, we call it, for any business. It's a CRM module. It's a slimmed down version of, Salesforce. Salesforce does a whole lot more than we do. We understand that. But again, we're focusing on the small business. So it starts with a CRM module. It has a quoting system at what have you. And then it moves on to the next natural step, if you want a bid. And that is a project module, project management module. Within it, there's the utilization resource module. There is the time tracking. There's the expense tracking. That's within the project management. And outside of that, which we call it the back end, you will find the billing and invoicing module. And there is also, to complete the answer for your question, within all of this stuff, just to complete it, there is an HR module. There is a notification and messaging module. Of course, there is a workflow, obviously, for a solution like this module. And there is a forecasting module.
Got it. Okay. Now, Chibert asked, Chibert, you used to run software that used the old time slips, right?
Yeah, time slips was kind of frustrating because it really was concentrating specifically on just tracking how much time you used. And then you had a big back-end office to handle all your billing and so forth. And this is sounding nice. Can I play?
All right. Why don't you go ahead and let's start the demo. This is the part that people actually, I mean, we like to see the software suites and solutions actually working. It's great to talk about it, but guide me through, let's say I've just installed this, and let's actually show me how some of those modules work.
Okay, wonderful. Would love to. Do we have the... We're going to show... Okay. Okay, so this is the solution. And just one point, there's nothing really to install. It's a pure SaaS module. So what we're looking at is the dashboard. So when you log in, it will be the screen with KPIs and what have you. Now, on the very top, you will see it's broken down by the modules. From left to right, you'll see the CRM, projects, financial approvals, and what have you, all the way ending with the HR and settings. Now, of course, depending on the package, depending on the security level you get, you don't have to see all these modules. So on the very top, so if we click on CRM, the second one from the top, you will see it's broken down to a simple CRM. It does a lot, but simple. Contacts, opportunities, opportunities. And from, of course, this is the dashboard and it's customizable. And from this point on, you create all your contacts, your typical jargon for CRMs. And each contact could have unlimited number of opportunities, and each opportunity could have unlimited number, of course, of the activities and quotes for that matter. But the nice thing is it's connected, it's all integrated. So when you create a quote, you could convert it within the system to a project. So it will grab all the information you have and the billing rates and what have you, and it will tell you what should be your proposal because it knows your rates. It's an integrated PSA solution. So it tells you, hey, Mr. User or Mrs. User, that according to your quote, according to the effort that you're putting in your quote, that's a $50,000. Do not quote less than that. Otherwise, you're going to be in red, for example. So that is the CRM. Now, if we go on to the next one, the projects on the very top, that's probably the core of this solution, obviously. And as you could see, the dashboard, it shows you all the projects, some high-level information about, you know, all this demo information. And below it, if you use the timesheets, you will see, going back 2 weeks, of course, reports will show you more than that, but if there are hours overdue and what have you. Now, if you click on this magnifying glass on any of these projects, you will go into the project itself. So as you can see, it's broken down again. Everything is broken down. Basic information, financial on the tabs, on the blue, staffing, analysis, collaboration. And you'll see the typical project management, the tasks, and the screen resolution probably is off a little bit here. But as you could see, you could create clone. That's another thing for, we hear it a lot from small business owners. They don't have time to recreate a project. It allows you to clone it and edit it as you wish after that. And we could hit on the time and attendance on the very top. And that's where people on would enter under my timesheet. They would enter. That's typical. Everybody's seen this before. They would enter their time, and they could put notes even on the time cell. For example, entering notes on a time cell, Padre, that was an important thing. Everybody was asking for it. They want to put notes on every single project day that they worked here or there. We added that, for example. You could see, you know, view your documents from there. Mm-hmm. You could do a lot, turn it on and off. The same thing, copy timesheet. We always after simplicity and how do we save time. So if someone's timesheet is similar to last week's, they could copy it and then edit it as they go. And they could submit it from that point on, and it goes to the approval workflow. And next one is expense, for example. And I'm sorry if I'm going too fast. You could stop at any point of time.
This is the perfect speed.
Great. Okay, so expense sheet, again, a similar UI. People enter their timesheet, upload their receipts, and it takes international as well currencies. So the nice thing, if you're working in France and you put things in, and you go eat, and you see 6 euros, you don't have to calculate it. You put 6 euros. You put what your eye see on the receipt. The software will do the conversion and show it to your manager in the U.S., €6, and that'll be like, I don't know, let's say $9, for example. Approved, not approved, you could put all kind of limits on this based on your company rules. And there's a really nice table for that to adjust it per country, per job grade, and what have you.
Oh, Michael, let me stop here, because we actually had a really good question in the chat room again from Big Ginge, who wants to know how connected this is. And I think the expansion of that question is, once your data is in, is it locked or is it easy to get it out to move it to a different application if let's say, their needs change?
That's a really good question. And we get this question all the time because people want to be safe. They don't want to be locked in. The data is all yours. In other words, with Vorex, you could tell us tomorrow that we could do it for you, actually. We have done it very few times, but luckily. But we could provide them the table structure with their data, of course. We could give it to them in an Excel spreadsheet, and they could export it through built-in APIs and exportable reports, raw reports, with, like, all their data from within without even calling us. So if they want to go to another company, we'll be more than glad to support that all the way.
Oh, okay, I got it. Okay, so it's not locked in, but since it's a service, they just approach you and they say, this is the kind of data we need out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. We could provide it to them, or they could pull it out themselves.
Okay. All right. Now, let me back this off a little bit, because I want to be honest and I want to be critical. We've got a couple of people in the chat room, specifically Echelon, who's saying they like what they see. They like the engagement that you have between the start of data input and then the various steps that you need to make in order to run that through an SMB. But a lot of them are wondering, well, are you going to be improving the UI? Is this how it's going to work? Because they look at something like Salesforce, and they look at something like FreshBooks, and they say UI counts for a lot, and some of them are just not feeling the interface. How did you come by this interface? How did you decide that this was going to be the look of your product?
Okay, another good question. I like critical questions, actually. It's very helpful for everybody. Vorex had a different UI before. This is, let's call it version 2.0 of the UI. This year, amongst many, many other initiatives, we're bringing in some of our clients, actually, on our roadmap. Some of our clients, we're getting experts in UIs, and we're going to put them together, and we're going to change it. So this UI, you see, is going to take a pretty big facelift, probably around the third quarter of this year. So we're trying to always improve it. We don't want to overdo it. I mean, it's something we don't like to do a lot because we want people to feel at home when they go in. We don't want to change it every 2-3 months. So it's a big event. Maybe it's not a huge technical event, but it's a big impactful event for our users. So we try to do it as right as possible and with as little frequency as possible.
Got it. I got it. So you've baked this in. This is what your customers are used to, and so you don't really want to give them a big jolt.
Exactly. And that's very important. I mean, any time we do enhancement to the software, if we believe it can have any jolt, let's call it jolt, we make it a setting. For example, if there's a new screen that looks different or new fields that we're introducing, we don't say, surprise, you have it, unless it was very transparent. We tell all our clients that there is a switch in the settings. You could turn it on and off, and it will be your default from that point on. And we tell them what it looks and what's the benefit. So it's up to them. It's there if they want to switch it.
Got it. But we have a question here from our very own director of engineering, Radford, who asked a very simple question. He said, are you planning to white label your solution?
Well, I feel like I'm working and talking to people that work with Vorex. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And that's part of the reason, by the way. I mean, I came here for the setting here, but I also had some contacts I'm going to be talking with here in San Francisco in the Bay Area, is how can we work with other, we could call them channel partners, resellers. They come in under different names. On unifying a way to work with a XYZ company, and that could be, a company here in the Bay Area, or it could be AT&T. I mean, just for legal purposes, we don't have anything with AT&T now. I'm just saying that they would want to resell our product. And we're working with companies here, and we're starting to open up, these kind of conversation all around the country to white label it and give it to somebody to resell it for us.
The chat room is on. We got Max1234, who just, simple question, wants to know if your back end is a database or an API.
The back end is a database. We use Microsoft products, everything. We don't use open sources. We use all .NET, SQL, Microsoft SQL. And, of course, we do have APIs that we do not I'm just going to be very transparent in this conversation. We do not over-publicize the APIs. We don't want people just running crazy with them. It's anybody that asks for them, we open it up for them. They're there and everything. But it's per request kind of thing.
Got it.
And that totally makes sense to me. I mean, because this is a service. I mean, this is not something that they're going to be downloading and installing on their own servers and having to service themselves. This is something that you handle in the cloud for them. All right. Now, I interrupted you before you were able to get through the full suite, and I do want to give you the opportunity to run through it. So, go ahead. Continue. Sorry.
Thank you very much. No, great question. So we're back to the screen, I think. All right. Amazing.
There we go.
So we were at the expenses, and so that's where you enter your expenses. Again, very familiar screens to everybody probably. You could print them and upload the receipts, as I was saying a second ago. If we go up again, please, and then we have all project. That's just showing you all the projects. So, in other words, if you're not the project manager, but you have the admin access, you could see everybody. So, security and roles is very important. Not everybody needs to see everything unless you tell the software that it needs to be seen by this person or that person. Next to that, we would have the forecasting. The forecasting is pretty nifty. It was created based on clients' needs. Again, with this forecasting, you could create a mock-up project before it starts, staff it, put the billing rates, everything, and even estimate how many hours they're going to put per person per task for the next 2 months or next 5 years and what have you. And then when the real project part starts, the real time is entered by people. This forecasted project continuously run in the background, and it gives the management a comparison. So it says, Mr. Manager, you told me, the software's talking now, that Tim should be putting 20 hours that week for that project. But in reality, he's putting 25 hours. There's an issue. You're going to be off by the end of this project. It's a trajectory kind of solution. And the next one is issue tracking. There's a built-in module to open tickets. And, of course, when you open a ticket, again, a lot of familiar words here for our technical audience probably, it immediately sends an email notification saying, you know, Linda, you have a ticket, do this and that, and it has a priority of so-and-so. And then she could go in and update it and put the hours, how long it took her to do it and reassign it until it's closed. So really, when you think about it, that's really a module by itself that right. is, you know, but it's built in because we believe that companies might need it. The next major module you'll see is the finance module. And that's really where you would, as hours go in and as expenses go in, based on your billing rates, you could create the bill, the invoice, to invoice your contracting company, to invoice your client. So really any invoicing you want, to get money or to receive money. Payments, I mean, receivables, in other words. Everything is done from here. And it's pretty nifty because you create the invoice. The software even allows you to put discounts, manage the payments that come in. There's a lot behind this. It's not just sending out invoices and emailing them out and what have you. This one does a lot. The approval, the next one is what it says. Practically, if you have something pending approval, oh, we have something here in the demo. That's great. So if you hit the magnifying glass, that's a manager. That's what they get when it's time to approve something. So they could reject it or approve it with notes. So the submitter will know immediately. And the nice thing about it, the software understands that you could be working for different managers for different projects. So if your timesheets have two different projects for two different managers, it could have its own work approvals that are different, two different routes. It knows how to slice the hours, send it to manager A, manager B, and it does all this work that is really tedious if you try to do it manually. The next one, if we could close that one, is the reports. And that's, of course, reports is reports. It's broken down, as you see to your right, by the area overall, what reports you're looking to find. And the majority are under projects and time and attendance, of course, by the nature of the software itself. And you have my favorites to the left. So you don't have to look for each report every day in the morning. Of course, you could export them to several outputs. Messaging, the next one, that's pretty simple, nothing too fancy, but you could send messages. But the nice thing about it is it understands your system. So if you create a message and you want to create a new message, because at the bottom it says new message, because if you click on that, thank you. As you could see, it's not a substitute of an email, right, but it understands your company because it's working around your company. You could send it to a role, to a branch. to a department, to a person, and with a send message date. So it's kind of a smart messaging because it understands your company.
Well, I can see how that's useful if you're trying to backtrack a project, figure out how it developed. This could actually does it like keep all the messages that are connected to particular invoices or particular projects in one group, one structure. So you could say this is all the messaging attached to project 5.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that makes sense. Yeah. That's a really good reason why you'd want to use this messaging rather than say the Outlook or the Exchange server that you're currently using, because you could actually group together all the communication that has to do with a particular project.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very excellent point. That's exactly what it is. So and then the next one is if we go up my screen here, the HR. Now that's kind of interesting.
How did you get a module for HR?
Clients, I'm telling you, we build on what clients want. We visited so many, and we kept hearing this like, so how do I get my information to my PSA software? How do I do this? So over the years, we developed really above and beyond. I mean, a typical thing in a PSA, you see a user database, but not an HR, to your point. So if we do a view users, I'm getting help from Chris here, on the very top, the second one from the right, the quick links, view users, we have a demo, so God knows what kind of information we have. So if we click on the pencil on the very left side, you will see the kind of information we hold. It's not the user password only. I mean, it's a lot of information, as you could see from the blue tabs, and we don't have to go through all of them, self-explanatory overall.
Right.
So, and the skills, by the way, it's a very interesting tab. The PSA comes with a skills engine. You could upload all the skills. We do not impose them. They are related to your business. So if you are, let's say, a healthcare provider, so skills could be certification, I don't know, so many skills. You could define all the skills that you want in your database, and then you could assign them to people with experience levels. So you could say Tom has these 6 skills, but Linda has these 7 skills with that experience. What that does, it's not just a repository part. When you create a project, there is an engine inside the software to say, you know what, I want these skills to be in this project for this client. The software will help you with giving you a selection of who are the best fit people based on the skills needed for this project. This comes handy when, you know, your company is a little bit bigger than 5 employees and you know all your employees. If you have 30, 40, 100, that becomes a problem. Calling people, calling managers, like, do you have these skills? Do you have these employees with these skills? Do you have the availability? Because the software tells you, yeah, the top 3 choices have these skills, but they're at 100% capacity. Mr. Manager, look at number 4. He's at only at 25% capacity, and so on and so forth.
You know, it's interesting because as you've been talking, I've been trying to think of scenarios in which I'd want another tool. I've been trying to think of, okay, so what are the cases in which this isn't going to be enough? And for a small and medium business, you really have it. You've got it covered pretty well. I mean, as far as I can tell, if, let's say, we had an SMB here in the Silicon Valley that was doing consulting work for programming modules for other startups around the area, you've got everything from my HR module, so I know who works for me and I know what skills they have. Then I can attach them to certain projects, follow those projects all the way from the inception of the project, the messaging of the project, to the deployment of the project, development and deployment, to the invoicing. I mean, chat room, help me out here. I'm trying to figure out a scenario in which this wouldn't be enough. I like what I have so far. But while chat room's coming up with that, let me ask you this, because this question has been circulating around for a while in our chat room. They want to know if this is your end game. I mean, do you think Vorex is going to stay as an SMB solution? Or if it gains traction, is your ultimate game to make this an enterprise solution? So do you grow it? Another way of asking it is, if an SMB starts with your solution and they've got, 10, 20, 30 employees and it's perfect, and then they grow, will Vorex eventually have an enterprise offering, or are you really committed to SMB?
Committed 100%, Padre.
Okay.
Very, very much so. I mean, that's our focus. This is our bread and butter. This is what we do. We look at other companies. They are serving the enterprise. It's kind of well served, I guess. So we are focused. We are building and more on this software, but with one focus, SMB. This is just Vorex. This is what we do. Now, the nice thing about it is, can it be used with the bigger SMBs? And the answer is yes. It's pretty flexible, as is, without changing anything. We're working with somebody that has 550 employees. And they're just about to, actually, as we speak, I was coming and, you know, emailing right before I came to the studio. They love it and they want to work with it. But definitely they would love us more when they are, you know, 100, 150 all the way down to 5 employees. This is the sweet spot, I should say.
One last question from the chat room. And I do have to say this is the last one. Sorry, we're just getting too close to the end of time here. From Unfed, who wants to know about partner support. He wants to know, basically, will you support partners who want to resell your service or integrate it into a package that they are offering to SMBs? Or do you have work opportunities for people who want to work with your solution? I mean, is that part of your strategy? Or right now, you're purely a services company and you handle just your service?
Another great question. There will be the two options because we have this. This is our roadmap for this year, so I have it. I have it memorized. We will have two different routes with partnership. One of them will be you take it. We provide the service. We provide the technology. You run with it. You do your service. We train you, of course, and then you run with it. The other line will be. You sell the service, and we'll support it 100%. So we worry about everything, the back end, all the headaches that comes with it, and all you have to do is just provide it to your... So both routes are being not considered, actually, will be happening this year.
Thank you. Mike, I want to thank you for coming on here. We actually handed you a really, really difficult segment because unlike many of the other segments we do on the show, we did not do a practice of this at all. There was no rehearsal. I did not give you the questions in advance. So everything that came from me, everything that came from my host, everything that came from the chat room was complete on the spot. And I think you handled it very, very well. You know, not a lot of people can handle chat room, but I think you did it with aplomb.
I'm sweating. You cannot see it, but okay. It's transparent.
Now, before we call a close to this segment, I want to go back to Chibert and to Curtis. You've listened to this. You've heard the pitch. You've heard the solution. Starting with you first, Curtis, when you look at this and you compare it to what we have on the enterprise side, because these solutions do exist, most notably with Salesforce, on the enterprise side, do you see the difference between a service, a product targeted towards enterprise, and a service product targeted toward SMB?
The place where you see the big differences, frankly, comes with the number of add-ons available. I mean, Salesforce now, in addition to being a set of products, is a platform that a lot of other companies have built add-ins, bolt-ons for. Many people within a lot of enterprises live in Salesforce the way that some people will live within SAP and others will live within the Microsoft desktop productivity products. So there's that. There's also the ability to easily coordinate thousands of users set up in departments and groups. I think those are the two big areas. Is it an application suite versus a platform? And just how far will the coordination and management structure scale? Those, in general, are going to be the two big differences, not necessarily the functionality at any given state for a particular individual.
Fantastic. Chibert, on to you. Last words about an SMB solution that, again, I'm not hearing anything from chat room that they have a scenario in which it wouldn't work. Seems to be comprehensive for small to medium business.
Actually, this is something that I want to take a good hard look at for managing projects within the university. Our number one problem is our fiscal people are overburdened. Our HR people are overburdened. We don't have enough resources. And more the projects have to manage their own resources just so they can keep ahead of all the problems, and especially reporting for federal grants. This is something like this is what I've been waiting for on managing my grants and making sure that we don't run out of money too soon. That HR module is awesome. I love the fact that it's in there, and I can also keep track of my engineering time because I have to pay my engineers on an hourly basis because they are cost recovery. So this actually fits very nicely into research grants.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, I want to thank you all, and I want to thank you. That's right, our listener, our watcher. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 HR folk. Now, I do want to thank my panelists. Specifically, I want to thank Mike for coming up here, for making the drive, for being in studio, for really letting us grill you. I mean, we threw a lot of difficult questions. We didn't softball anything, and I think you came out on top. Do you want to tell the folks right now, here's your 60-second plug, anything you want to tell them about Vorex, about where to find you, about how to communicate you, how about how to ask questions?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for everybody. Actually, I was trying to read and listen and read the chat while
I'm talking. We told you not to do that.
There's a lot of comments about the beard, so very funny. I'm reading that. But very smart audience. I'm very impressed. The questions are right to the point. Just amazing. Well, this is my 60 seconds, I guess. All I could say is go to Vorex.com if you're interested in it. There's a lot of information on it. There's a free trial. It's really committed. It's not a trick or what have you. Free trial is free trial. Now, if a salesperson called you, that's not my fault. Okay, you could just hang out. But go check it out. It gives you all information. If you need a demo, when the salesperson contacts you through email, they'll do it probably once. Just let them do a demo for you. It's a go-to meeting for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, depends on how much time you want, but these 30 minutes could save you hours of research of what's the good software for your company. So I would say everything is on that website. I recommend anybody who has any interest in the technology or the solution to take a look at it.
Thank you, Mike. You did fantastic. Well done. And
you
should be proud. And Vorex should give you an all-expense-paid vacation in Hawaii.
Please tell them, okay?
Now, you know who else deserves an all-expense-paid vacation to Hawaii is Brian Chi. Oh, wait, he lives there. Brian, how are things? Tell us, what do you want the Twite Right to know about?
I want the Twite Right to know that I love them. The chat room's awesome, and it's been great. You guys give is, you know, all kinds of great information, and I'm especially happy that Rick Dell was sharing some of the things that have changed in the world of time slips. I used to do a lot of legal office support, and time slips was both a joy and a frustration. So thanks for the extra knowledge, Rick.
Oh, thanks, G-Bert. And Curtis, of course, we can't forget you. What's coming up on enterprise efficiency, and what should the Twite Right know about?
Well, we've got lots of solid pieces of good journalism. Would recommend, frankly, if people are interested in the intersection of IT and automobiles, they look at a piece I put up on Friday that's all about my visit to the Shelby American plant. I have some video, have a bunch of still photos. I modestly think it's a pretty good article. Also got a lot of great stuff. You know, I'm getting ready next month. I'll be heading to Houston for the big Microsoft Tech Ed. The month after that, I'll be in Orlando for SAP's Sapphire. And look, before too long, if you're interested in security, we're going to start doing some radio shows in conjunction with the Black Hat Conference and wow. Dark Reading. So that should be a lot of fun. Just all kinds of things keeping me busy down here in the swamp.
Curtis, we expect to see you in a Black Hat at some point in the near future. We'll just say that.
We can do that.
Absolutely. Now, folks, I also want to thank, again, the loyal fans of This Week in Enterprise Tech. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't be able to bring you all this enterprise goodness each and every single week. So I want to do something for you. And it's the same thing I'm going to do for you every single week. And that is give you an easier way to get our episodes into your devices automatically. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet, you'll find not just all of our shows, but also a drop-down menu that gives you the RSS feed so you can get every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech delivered to your iPad or your iPhone or your Android phone or tablet. Basically, any device you want, your PC, your laptop, your desktop, it's all good. And you can select the version that's going to play out best for you, be it audio, video, or high-definition video. It's part of the reason why we love you so much, because you help us pay the bills. Also, why not visit us at our YouTube page at youtube.com/twiet. There you will be able to find not just all of our episodes, but we've also broken out all of the individual small segments, those pre-recorded segments that we do from time to time. Stuff My IT Guy Says, The Data Closet, Pro Gear, Pro Tip, all those things that give you insight into the world of the IT geek. Also, did you know that you could follow me on Twitter? Yeah, that's right. If you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, you'll find my feed. And if you follow me, you'll be able to communicate with me. Tell me what you want to see on future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. In fact, many of our episodes, many of our topics, I take straight from that feed. You'll also find out what I do when I'm not on TWiET. I do other shows here on the TWiT TV network. I do Know How at 11 o'clock on Thursdays Pacific Time, and also Coding 101 at 1:30 p.m. on Thursdays, as well as Padres Corner on Fridays at 7 o'clock p.m. It's all part of the fun that is me and TWiT. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the studio for making this show possible, specifically to Karsten, my super producer, to Lisa and Leo, and, oh, and to my TD. I believe...
Who?
I believe, yeah, it's this new guy. I don't remember his... I thought we replaced him. He's actually in the Witness Protection Program. But, Brian, do you want to tell folks where they can find you on the TWiT TV network?
I think they could find me co-hosting with this weird guy on Know How. You might have already mentioned that. But also, you could follow me on Twitter, which I know Padre likes too, because I do a daily dose of Corgi.
Oh, Corgi butt.
Yep. So if you're interested in anything like that, you can find me on Know How. You can find me there on Twitter. And I substitute for Jason on this show occasionally when he's too busy to do it.
Yes, well, because we know you have a lot of free time.
What?
Now, beyond that, folks, thank you so very much for watching. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep TWiET.